The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers.
Hey, everybody, mark your calendars for November 7th. Join colleagues and presenters from AAP Colorado, Idaho, and Utah for our first ever regional CME. This virtual event will be interactive, case-based, and an engaging educational experience with a focus on current issues and hot topics of interest for pediatric professionals. Alisa, where could we go to find out more about this and to sign up?
Yeah, it's going to be a really fantastic event. Our speakers are dynamic. It's going to be great. You can find a link to register on aaputah.org under events under Fall Regional Conference. The registration link is there. Everyone is welcome. You don't have to be a member of the Utah, Idaho, or Colorado chapter to join us. It's open to everybody, and it's going to be a great, great day. So join us on November 7th.
Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We've been talking this month about MISC, laying the foundation, and this week we are going to dig deep into MISC. We're very fortunate to have our panel of guests back with us for a third week. This week we'll be having Dr. Beth Fuchen in the lead. Beth is an extraordinary hospitalist and deserves a big shout out for this whole month, because she's the one who brought this topic to us. As you know, we do take requests, and so she has been very generous in helping to lay this out for us this month. We also have Dr. Aaron Tremarkey back from pediatric rheumatology, and Dr. Nun Tran from pediatric cardiology. Do any of you have any conflicts you'd like to report?
No conflicts.
No.
I think I heard three no's on that. So I'm going to take that as a no, no, and a no. Is that safe?
Yes.
Okay. Beth, let's introduce you. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Columbus, Ohio.
And my understanding is you did your residency and a chief residency here at Utah?
Yes, that's right. So I did my medical school at the University of Cincinnati, and then decided to do a great out west adventure and came out here for my residency, stayed on for a chief year, and then I've been in a hospital here ever since.
And just never decided to leave.
Never left. I love it here.
What have you enjoyed?
There's just beauty all the time. I like to trail run. I like to do anything outside. I like to do yoga. But yeah, it's a great climate. It's a great place to be.
That sounds so well-rounded. Yeah, so nicely done. Nicely done. So this week we want to talk about MISC. Now, you three were all on this committee, but it's a very large committee. We should probably give credit to the fact that there were about 10 people on the committee. Is that right? Representing lots of different specialties, intensive care. The emergency department. Just lots of people who have really invested a lot of time into this. Now, my understanding is also that we are using, the point of departure for this is the WHO definition of MISC. Now, given that we're not currently subscribing to the WHO, does that mean that this is sort of like using our parents' Netflix account?
I think so. If you're going to follow along with not going with the WHO, you can always use the CDC guidelines, although I'm not really sure where we should stand with the CDC. But there are a couple of different guidelines out there. The AAP has guidelines, as well as like the American College of Rheumatology. The Royal College, if you want to become British, you can use any of those guidelines.
Are they substantially different?
They are slightly different. I think all of the guidelines are somewhat vague. And so the places where they're different just kind of leaves a lot of room for discussion and being open about if this patient meets criteria or not. And so that's why we convened a multidisciplinary group to go over our guidelines that we're going to have here in Utah.
But let's be honest, this is, you know, like we talked about with Dr. Tremarkey 2 weeks ago, this is one of those problems that if you don't think about it, you won't get there. But to get there, you kind of have to have a bunch of check boxes, because there's not a swab that you can swab somebody's throat and say, ha, we know what this is.
Yes, exactly.
So what are the criteria for the definition of MISC?
Well, I'm going to go through the WHO criteria, but I will say in our large committee here that we assembled at Primary Children's, we used multiple sets of guidelines. We all revised them and then came up with our guidelines. And I will say the different specialties involved were hospitalist medicine, the emergency department, intensive care, rheumatology, cardiology, infectious disease, and hematology. So it was a pretty large group that we assembled to pull together an algorithm that we could all somewhat agree on. But I will say what the WHO definition of MISC is. And again, MISC is multi-system inflammatory disease in children. So they have to be pediatric, so ages 0 to 19. And they have to have fever for greater than or equal to 3 days. But the height of the fever is not described. The others, you have to have 2 of the following 5 criteria. So 1, mucocutaneous involvement, either the hands or feet, as well as the skin. 2, hypotension or shock. 3, features of myocardial dysfunction, pericarditis, valve or coronary artery abnormalities. 4, a coagulopathy, mostly as identified by prolonged coagulation times and changes in fibrinogen and D-dimer. And 5, acute GI symptoms such as diarrhea, vomiting, or abdominal pain. So again, 2 of any one of those 5.
And basically what you've described here are 4 or 5 different organ systems looking for a multi-organ system disease.
Right. I guess to sum it up, I would say 2 of the 5, skin, hypotension, cardiac, coagulopathy, and GI.
Okay. What else?
You also have to have elevated inflammatory markers. Again, that's all the guidelines say. It doesn't say what inflammatory markers or how high. And then no other cause of inflammation. So you've ruled out other diagnoses. And the last one is evidence of COVID-19 infection or a likely contact or exposure with COVID-19.
Okay, so let me just run quickly through a couple of questions that I have just sort of scattershot through those. First of all, the age of 0 to 19, obviously because it's a pediatric disease, is there a similar disease seen in adults, or is this confined to pediatrics?
This syndrome does seem to be confined to pediatrics. I think early on when COVID-19 spread across the world, pediatricians took a sigh of relief thinking that children were relatively spared, but it seems like children are the ones who are affected by this multi-system inflammatory disease.
When you said it doesn't matter which inflammatory markers, which ones do you obtain?
Yeah, so there are quite a few, but I would say the hallmark ones are an elevated ESR and CRP, just like Dr. Tremarki commented on.
Okay. Also, on the issue of timing of disease, does this happen usually while a child is ill, immediately after, or how long after? And obviously, as you know, with an emerging disease, there's still things we're learning, but where does this fit?
That's a great question. It's described as a post-inflammatory syndrome. So in pediatrics, we're familiar with other post-infectious inflammatory syndromes, such as rheumatic fever, and this is something like that. So the timing is weeks, somewhere between probably 2 and 6 weeks after a COVID infection or exposure. And I'll clarify that as infection or exposure. So many children who end up having MISC don't necessarily have a very significant illness preceding their MISC. They may have had a febrile illness, they may have had a little bit of cough and congestion, or they may have had no symptoms at all.
Now, one of the difficulties here, obviously, is that there are a couple of unifying factors. These are kids, they have fever by definition, and they have proximity to COVID, because it sounds like they've either been diagnosed with it or they have a known exposure. And then we have this cluster of other things. So there's not a single look for this. Am I mistaken?
You're not mistaken. I think that that's the difficult thing about this. It's because it is a multi-system disorder. You can have one or other symptoms that are predominant and having those be the primary chief complaint. But then there can be many other symptoms as well.
So what I mean by that is this could by definition be somebody who has who presents with abdominal pain and coagulopathy, but not the other things. Or it could be somebody who shows up with mucocutaneous signs and GI signs. Is there kind of a typical look from what we're seeing? My guess is that these are generally patients who are sicker than average. Mm-hmm.
If I had to use the term illness script, if I had to write an illness script for someone, I would say this is going to be a school-aged child who's had fever for several days, some abdominal pain, perhaps some nausea and vomiting, may have other constitutional symptoms like fatigue, headache, sore throat, and then may or may not have a rash. Neurologic changes or significant headache may be a part of that, but that's the difficult thing is some of the systems that are involved are not necessarily symptomatic systems, such as coagulopathy, and even the cardiac symptoms are not necessarily chest pain. They might just be general feeling of unwellness or fatigue.
How sick are these kids? Are these kids showing up in clinic, or are they showing up in the hospital?
That's the tricky part. I think many of them have such vague symptoms that they may present anywhere. Of course, the more severe ones with more significant symptoms will likely present to an urgent care or emergency room, but this could very easily walk into your office.
And so how does this affect our seeing patients? So you know, clearly one of the things that we do all the time in a pediatric office is seeing abdominal pain. Is this usually an acute abdominal pain? Do we see it more likely in somebody who has chronic abdominal pain? How does that all fit?
I would say it's acute abdominal pain in that it's not persisting for very long before people seek medical attention, but I would say it's not a sudden onset of abdominal pain. It's over the course of a few days.
Or a few days as opposed to weeks?
Yes, as opposed to weeks.
Okay. So what things are going to look like this that we need to not miss?
I think that's why I really am interested in this disease process is it can look like a lot of things. It's definitely a multi-system disease that can have a lot of different presentations, but I would say predominantly it looks like every other viral illness, which makes it really challenging. And then it looks like a lot of other itises. So it could be hepatitis, cholecystitis, pyelonephritis. So all of the other, you know, abdominal organs can be inflamed as well. And all of those things are much more common than MISC.
What should we not miss? I mean, it strikes me, for instance, that we would not want to miss sepsis in the process.
I think that's the biggest diagnosis to not miss is sepsis from any etiology, but particularly if they have a rash, I would think of toxic shock syndrome, either from group A strep or staphylococcus, as high up on my differential diagnosis. And then because of the abdominal pain as well, a lot of these children look much like appendicitis, which again is much more common than MISC.
What would the differentiating factors be with appendicitis? And can you get appendicitis as part of the inflammation, or should that be different?
I'll answer that second question first. It's a good one. There are some reports of people having certainly appendicitis-like symptoms and then getting imaging, and there's some mesenteric lymphadenitis in that area or even some right lower quadrant inflammation, and so that makes it really challenging. There have been many children who've also had their appendixes removed, and then get better for a little bit and then actually kind of resume their inflammatory state and then come back in.
It seems to me as we look at this that there seem to be a couple of organ systems that don't get involved very often. And I don't see reference here to pulmonary or renal issues. Is that usually the case?
It's a good question. They are involved, but I would say they're almost innocent bystanders. I would say the reports of everything published, these children have very minimal respiratory symptoms, particularly infectious respiratory symptoms. They don't have much in the way of cough or difficulty breathing, but the ones who do, who have tachypnea or shortness of breath or chest pain, it's likely secondary to their cardiac manifestations and not a pulmonary process. So decreased pump function causing backup and pulmonary edema, causing the tachypnea and shortness of breath. And the renal injury, so elevated BUN and creatinine, is actually generally from hypovolemia and their shock-like state rather than an intrinsic renal process.
And the involvement of the organ systems that are involved, is that tissue level inflammation, or is it more like a vasculitis, or what happens that makes them inflamed? Do we know?
That's a great question that I'm not sure I know the answer to, so I might ask my colleagues to see if they know.
Well, and maybe we could bring that up in our question session in a couple of weeks. What do we know about mortality and recovery rates of MISC?
So right now, it seems like the mortality is low, but it's not zero. I just checked, the CDC does have a tracker on its website, and at latest count, there were 935 cases in the United States, and 19 deaths, which I get is about 2%.
Okay. Now, it's probably important for us to put this in a historical context because, you know, a lot of times when we talk about historical context, we're talking about, Lord so-and-so in 1731 first described this. This was first described this year, right?
Right. It's a fascinating timeline. There was actually a case report published in Hospital Pediatrics on April 7th about a child with Kawasaki disease, who was also positive for COVID. And then at the end of April, there started to be more reports from Europe about an increasing rate of what they called an inflammatory disease or multi-system disease, some of which had phenotypic features of Kawasaki disease. That was in late April to early May, both from England and from Italy. And then in New York, saw a large surge of Kawasaki-like illness and multi-system dysfunction in the month of May. So this is a very new diagnosis.
I mean, let's be honest, we're talking in September. This is a very compressed timeline. It was referred to initially as a Kawasaki disease. How is this different from Kawasaki disease?
The children are sicker. Sometimes with Kawasaki disease, you can get a shock-like state, and we'll call it Kawasaki shock syndrome, where they do have significant cardiac dysfunction and not just coronary artery involvement. But that's rare. These children are much more likely to present in a shock-like state with either hypotension or cardiogenic shock. And they're a little bit older than the children with Kawasaki disease as well. They don't always have all of the phenotypic features of Kawasaki. The things that are predominant are the rash and the conjunctivitis, but less prominent are the lymphadenopathy.
Okay. So once you have made the diagnosis, what do you do to treat these kids?
Because it is such a multi-system disease, we have a multi-system team involved. And that's actually why I love hospital medicine. I think one of my specialties, is multi-system disease in the hospitalized patient. So if you're thinking about this diagnosis, I think getting our MISC team involved. And so we have a team that is made up of all of those specialties that we had mentioned before, who will come together and convene. We've been doing it on Zoom. And I think we're kind of becoming much more facile with Zoom conference consultation. And all discussing from all of our different vantage points what the differential could be and what the workup should be, and then where should we proceed with treatment.
About how many cases have you treated so far?
By our last count, we've had 14 cases since we've been tracking at the end of April. Our first case here was April 22nd. So from April 22nd until, the end of September, we've had 14 cases.
Is this all supportive, or is it? Is there any pharmacologic stuff that you guys are doing?
Much of the early care of the patient is diagnosis and supportive management of their shock. It's interesting, as we created this flow algorithm for treatment, we kind of had this offshoot of just treat shock per ICU and just kind of stopped there. And our ICU colleague said, that's great. We've got it from there, because we weren't really sure if it's, you know, vasoplegic shock versus cardiogenic shock. And there's all these shock things that you can do, but the shock is managed in the ICU. our rheumatology colleagues have helped with immune modulating medications, as well as in conjunction with our cardiologists. And then our hematologists and cardiologists have been helpful with the anticoagulation that seems to be necessary as well.
So, and do most patients go home on medications? And we talked a little bit last week with Dr. Tron about the follow-up afterwards, and looking for signs of post-inflammatory things. Is this like Kawasaki disease in that you continue anti-inflammation for any period of time?
Yes, most patients do end up going home on some sort of anticoagulation and some sort of immune suppression. And I might here have Dr. Trung and Dr. Trungraki discuss their medications.
Mm-hmm. Feel free, jump in.
Go ahead. You can go ahead, Erin, with the immunomodulators.
Okay. So there have been a couple of different immunomodulators that have been used in the treatment of MISC. And the treatments that we're using at Primary Children's Hospital, we've agreed upon through discussion with our colleagues across the United States and even internationally. We've had, rheumatologists get together for meetings. We've had our infectious disease colleagues weigh in. And so one of the medicines that's being commonly used, and looking at the CDC data, about 80% of children with MISD receive IVIG, so immunoglobulins. Mm-hmm. That tends to be the most common treatment that is used. When we get into this level of hyperinflammation, meaning when the immune system is turned on and either can't turn itself off or is just in overdrive, that's when we need other immunomodulatory medications to help turn the immune system off, since this is a post-infectious inflammatory response. And in that case, the rheumatology standby of steroids is one of our mainstays.
Just love them.
We had a very long discussion with our multidisciplinary team about how much steroids is enough steroids.
Uh-huh.
So depending on the level of inflammation and what phenotype they're looking at, like with their MISC, whether it's more of a Kawasaki disease phenotype, which I will let Dr. Chung talk about, or a cytokine storm-like phenotype, that would affect the use of steroids. There are also immunomodulatory agents that are being used that we commonly use as rheumatologists. And one of those is interleukin-1 inhibitors. So anakinra or canakinumab are the names of those interleukin-1 inhibitors that we have here in the United States. Anakinra is the one that we commonly use because it has a short onset of action, and it also has a very short half-life. So we're not worried about giving an immunomodulatory agent that's going to be in the system for, say, weeks or months. Mm-hmm. And that's really because of the similarity between the hyperinflammation that we see in MISC and the hyperinflammation that we're seeing in some of these children with MISC.
Terrific. And Nan, you want to comment?
Yeah. So as Dr. Tremarki mentioned, I think our treatment has depended somewhat on what the presentation is like. And in those that meet criteria for Kawasaki disease, whether it's complete versus incomplete, and again, it's hard to tell the difference what is MISC versus MISC versus KD, but if they do meet criteria, they would get the typical IVIG. We've also used anti-inflammatory dosing of aspirin. Okay. Even in terms of anticoagulation for the MISC patients in general, there had been an anticoagulation protocol developed for COVID-19 itself that had been developed within the hospital. So if they meet criteria for Lovenox prophylaxis based on that, then the MISC patients are often treated with prophylactic dosing of Lovenox. And if they don't meet criteria, we've often put them on antiplatelet dosing of aspirin, just because mm-hmm. if there is a chance of coronary artery involvement extrapolating from Kawasaki disease, we've done that. And so they'll often go home on aspirin, and we'll continue it for the 6 to 8 weeks that we usually do, as long as their coronaries have remained normal.
Because you're hoping this heart's going to work for another 100 years, and
is the hope. So
my guess is that in addition to formulating a plan for what happens in the hospital, that this group has also had some interest in formulating a plan for follow-up. Is that also the case?
Yes.
Yes. Yep. So actually, rheumatology and cardiology kind of are often messaging each other about the patients after they go home and sure. coordinating follow-ups and that sort of thing. So yes.
We also coordinate our laboratory follow-up because, Dr. Chan talked about the elevations of BNP and troponin. And then we talked a couple weeks ago about the elevations that you see in your different inflammatory markers like ESR or CRP, D-dimer. And many of the children who go home on steroids, we want to make sure as we're taking the steroid away that the inflammation isn't coming back.
Excellent. Yeah, and we'll also post a copy of the pathway on the website because I think it's hard to follow, obviously, just from listening. But we'll have that available as well. You know, the interesting thing to me in the paradigm of index of suspicion, one of the things that I think we've learned with the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak has been to stretch our minds to look at everyone and say, how is this not COVID? But this is an instance too where we have to think, how is this not COVID, but also how is this not something else as well? And it really, I think, is a challenge. And I really, really appreciate the time that you've all spent in putting this together, and equally the time that you spend in explaining this to us over the last couple of weeks. Beth, is there anything you want to say by way of closing?
I think as a take-home point, especially as a generalist myself, I would say if you're considering it, the ESR and the CRP could be very helpful to help you delineate how much inflammation is going on. And then if they're reassuring, careful close follow-up with anticipatory guidance is if there's clinical worsening of the patient, worsening abdominal pain, feeling more unwell, then having them seek medical advice again. And that anyone at Primary Children's, especially our MISC team, is always happy to do a phone consultation with anyone out there in urgent care or in a clinic practice to help delineate some of these things. It's pretty tricky.
And if you wanted to access that, is that through the emergency department? Or who would one ask for a consultation?
That's a fair question. The MISC team was trying to figure out which way we should go. And so if they're in the outpatient setting, rheumatology has graciously offered to be the first call. If they're in an emergency room and would like to talk to a pediatric emergency room provider, we have had our pediatric emergency room physicians being the first call, mainly because they're very helpful in that acute setting to make sure it's not something else like a surgical abdomen that would be addressed in the emergency room.
Again, how is this not something else? Terrific. Well, thank you all so much for your time and for your expertise. For those of you who have questions, because I know you do, send your questions to questions@ecurb.com, and we will plan to reconvene next week to deal with some of those questions. Thanks again for your time, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, vcurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design. Production design and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.